Hello, Peter Moore here. A few quick words before we get going today. First of all, thank you to everyone who listened to last week's episode with Ken Follett. We've had a lovely response to that episode, which has been one of our biggest yet. Remember, there's still time left to enter the prize draw to win one of two hardback copies of his brilliant new novel, The Evening and the Morning. All you have to do is visit our website, tttpodcast.com, and sign up to our newsletter by the end of the month. We've had also some really great messages from our listeners over the past week. It's good to hear from you with ideas for guests or comments about a recent episode. A tiny request from us in reply. If you are enjoying our podcast, please do consider leaving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It's one of the very best ways that you can help us out. It only takes a moment of your time on your phone or laptop. But now to today's business. This week, we have a frenzied population, an exponential curve, and a spectacular financial crash. Sound familiar? Welcome to Travel Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. Next month marks the 300th anniversary of one of the first and most devastating of all stock market crashes. It's an event that haunted Georgian imaginations and is remembered to history as the South Sea Bubble. The South Sea Bubble is often viewed in isolation as a dramatic event, but in his new book, the writer Thomas Levinson explains that it really was the produce of the powerful historical forces that were shaping the new enlightening world. At that time, the bubble was blown up by a new kind of person, the projector, who unleashed the new powers of mathematics upon British society. Thomas Levinson is Professor of Science Writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the best-selling author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, and now he's back with a new work, Money for Nothing, The South Sea Bubble and the Invention of Modern Capitalism. It's been praised by Simon Sebag Montefiore as superb, fascinating, and totally timely. I caught up with Tom down the line the other day to accompany him back on a travel through time. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you. Welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast.
Well, thank you so much.
We're going to be talking today about Money for Nothing, which is a book that centres on an episode in history that lots of people might have heard of, which is known, I think, best as the South Sea Bubble, would you say? Is that the right way to turn it?
That's the grand old name.
That's the grand old name. But the history actually goes much deeper than that, and you take the broad look at the story, explaining how this event was generated by forces that have been at play over really 50 years or more beforehand. I thought it'd be really good if you started off just broadly telling us a little bit about some of those forces that I'm alluding to.
Well, there is something that historians call the financial revolution in England and then Britain, which is the development of all kinds of things to do with getting and spending, and in particular, making money over time, starting really in the mid-16th century in some ways, but accelerating greatly in the mid-17th century, and especially with developments during the Commonwealth and then in the restoration of the Stuarts. You see things like the growth of a stock market and the beginning of mathematical analyses of money, things like present value calculations to know how much a piece of land was worth. Private banks start to emerge, checking accounts emerge. All this stuff is happening. And it's happening at the same time as a more famous revolution that we've all heard of is going on. It's called the Scientific Revolution. Sort of one of the things that really got this book going was sort of noticing that those two things were not just coincident in time, they were actually connected. And so really I was struck very much by how from really the 1640s, 50s, and especially accelerating, just really picking up steam in the 60s, you have people thinking about experience in a really different way.
Absolutely.
They're applying measurement and empiricism and number and calculation to all kinds of things. And it's not just, you know, the fall of a cannonball or, you know, how many dust motes there are on a head of a pin or whatever it may be. It's things to do with money and how people deal in the idea of putting a price on the future.
That's a good overview, but we should probably come to the character right now who straddles both of these worlds, the history of finance and the history of science. Isaac Newton is someone who you've written about before, and he features really heavily early on in the book, doesn't he?
Isaac Newton is, you know, he's both an obsession of mine and somebody whom it's reasonable to be obsessed about. I mean, he's just this remarkable figure. He's important for two reasons in this book. First, because he's the absolute captain of the revolution that's changing how we use math to understand what we do in life. And then he's a player. He actually shows up in the latter half of the book as well as somebody who's directly involved in the events that are the sort of the disaster that is the climax of the book. But at this early stage in the 1660s, when he's still in his 20s and nobody's heard of him and nobody knows him, he begins to think very, very deeply about two things at once. One is that, yes, you can use math not just to play with mathematical ideas, but to actually model experience. You can do things like analyze the fall of an apple from a tree, if you want, or the motion of the moon. You know, you can do fascinating things with the way light bends in different media and all this kind of stuff. And you can apply mathematics to all of that. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, people don't realize how extraordinary and experimental scientist Newton was. But that's what he was. He was a great experimentalist. And he not just measured things, he came up with protocols so that you knew the measurements were accurate or that you knew how big the errors had to be and no bigger. And that was so important in developing not just his specific work, that was very important there, but a whole idea of how you use the sort of scientific habits of mind to make sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
You measure things precisely, you measure things in ways that can be quantified, and then you take that precise, accurate, trustworthy information and you do things to it mathematically to understand how it behaves in different circumstances.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about the early part of your book, because you start with theoretical philosophy, or however you want to describe it at the time, being done, which is then slowly but surely converted into something which is a practical use in day-to-day life. It's really interesting to see that journey. It's a kind of history of ideas moment, really. But yeah, you talk about the new quantitative approach to nature, which is pioneered by Newton's work on things like the calculus. But then, yeah, there's this little bridge and people start noticing and start thinking. And there's characters like Edmund Halley that you write about as well. And I thought that was a kind of, it was a surprise to me when I was picking up the book and thinking that we were going to be plunged straight into the 18th century and to find myself back in the scientific revolution, but amplified my knowledge in all sorts of ways.
I hope it made some sense. The thing I would say, what you just said is absolutely correct, except that the application of the stuff to practical matters was always in parallel with the development of new mathematical ideas. I mean, as soon as somebody came up with a mathematical thought that could be turned to some practical use, these were enormously practical people. Mm-hmm. And the distinction that we make now between theoretical and experimental science, or, you know, research and development, these kinds of things, those were not distinctions that made a whole lot of sense in the late 17th century. People did everything all at once.
That's a really good point, and I suppose it reminds us of the ethos of the Royal Society in its very early history, which was to kind of do good practical things.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go back, and these are all accessible free online, and just browse through the early issues of the Proceedings of the Royal Society, you find just an extraordinary, delightful, ridiculous juxtaposition of these, you know, landmarks of the scientific revolution with reports of a two-headed calf. You know, the idea that you could look at nature, you could look at experience, you could talk about how things are manufactured in, you know, Morocco as opposed to in Europe or whatever it may be, everything was grist for the mill. The idea that you could observe increasingly rigorously, I mean, in the early days there was all kinds of stuff, gentlemen sending in curiosities from their gardens, as it were. But there was fantastic stuff, and particularly at certain moments, there was this extraordinary sort of capacity to take seemingly really mundane stuff and turn it into something profound. And you know, one of the stories in the book is from Edmund Halley doing just that. Somebody sends him a list of births and deaths in a minor German town, and he turns that into one of the very first actuarial tables, figures out how to price life insurance, you know, derives some statistical understanding of lifespans, of probability and risk in human life. All this stuff out of, you know, this very basic, prosaic list of, you know, vital statistics.
Mm, Absolutely. Two other little bits of context I want to get through before we start our main business. But one of them dovetails quite nicely with what you were saying, Nan. And this is the character of Daniel Defoe, who we'll get to later on. But he talks about this age of projects and the character of the projector being something that came into, we're talking probably 1690s, early 1700s now, the first couple of decades. Could you say anything about that, that kind of nature of being a projector and what that meant at the time?
What Defoe called a projector and what his contemporaries called a projector is what we would call something between an inventor and an entrepreneur. I love the late 17th, early 18th century. It's just a fabulous time. And one of the reasons it's so fabulous is it's one of the periods in British history where many of the sort of barriers or walls or conventions are just weaker than they were before and after. All kinds of people were doing all kinds of interesting things. You know, Defoe, one of his early long works was an essay on projectors. And he sort of talked about all the different things that people were trying to do, from new glassworks and mining and fun inventions. He himself invested badly in a project to invent a diving bell that would allow people to go underwater, which was something that was eagerly pursued in the late 17th century because there was a boom for trying to recover sunken treasure from lost Spanish treasure ships because of one great success in doing just that. And so people, including Defoe, got involved in trying to figure out the technology for actually getting down under the ocean, under the sea surface, and pick bars of silver and all that up from the bottom.
Yeah, I always remember this fact, and this is where we get a sense of continuing history, because I know from that famous autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, he says that on his father's little bookshelf in Milk Street in Boston in the early 1700s, one of the few books he had was Defoe's essay upon projects.
Yes.
And it always, it's a nice sense of like a little bit of what was happening in the 1690s, you know, then kind of rears up in a later moment in history across the Atlantic, because there's something potent and exciting and new and exhilarating about this age of projects. And I think you've described it really well. But the one last piece of context I wanted to mention before we get going is conflict, really, because the prime motivation for a lot of the action that we're going to talk about today was the fact that there was a huge national debt. Could you tell us where that debt came from?
So, and one of the things that happens in the 1690s, among the many inventions that occur then, is the invention of a truly national debt. Because what happens after the Glorious Revolution, when William and Mary take the throne, is Parliament, as a condition of bringing these two monarchs in place of the Stuart dynasty, imposes financial controls on them. It basically says Parliament has the power of the purse, and the national budget is not anymore, in some remote sense, you know, the personal purse of the king. It's actually something that has to be approved by Parliament and is thus a truly national obligation. And that allows Parliament, from the 1693 forward, to start raising money on guarantees that it issues on things like tax revenues or what have you, possible, you know, revenue streams. And it creates the first long-term interest-bearing obligations the people who elect, the limited franchise that elects Parliament, sort of has some control over. And it's important, it's vital, because starting in 1689, William and Mary launch into a series of wars that will last throughout what's often called the long 18th century, from 1689 to 1815 with the defeat of Napoleon. And it costs a lot of money to fight. It costs more money to fight in this era than it had previously. Armies grow larger, navies grow bigger, it just all gets more pricey. And therefore, year over year, revenue doesn't cover it, and Parliament, you know, issues more and more debt until it's several million pounds in 1690s currency, which is much, 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 much more than that now, and keeps
exactly.
growing.
It's, as you've got the. I think the figures are quite striking because I plucked them out of the book earlier, a bit like one of your projectors getting some treasure from the bottom of the sea floor. It was zero in 1693. It was 7 million. By 1697, and by 1713, it had risen to 40 million, which is, you know, these are quite sobering numbers.
They are indeed, and it's difficult always to apply inflation calculations into such different times and economies, but you can reasonably multiply that by 160 or so or more, if you and to get a sort of contemporary figure. It's a ton of money, and perhaps a better way to look at it is, in the best of times during peacetime, interest on the debt as it got up to those higher numbers would consume more than half of the annual revenue. That's just interest. So everything else that Britain felt like doing could only be done with that little bit. And of course, if you had to send an army into Europe, or if you were sending a fleet to deal with some miscreant somewhere, that would send the costs through the roof all over again.
Absolutely. So it's interesting how that will have an impact on policies going forward. But I think everything that we've said so far should be taken as a kind of setup for what we're going to talk about, because I'm now going to ask you the question I ask of everyone who comes on this podcast. And that's, if you could go back in time, if you could travel back in time to 1 year in the past, what year would you like to pick?
Well, that would be 1720.
Well, go for it. Tell us a bit about 1720 broadly before we get into the specifics.
1720 is a really exciting, fun year. There are all kinds of interesting things going on. Alexander Pope is publishing the last or second to last volume of his translation of the Iliad. It's making him rich. Britain is briefly at peace, so that's good. But the debt's huge, and the Whig government that's running the show at the time is trying to bring it under control, and they try to do so by striking a deal with something called the South Sea Company. Despite its name, that company wasn't trading to Tahiti. It was basically created as a monopoly of British trade with the Spanish port, the Atlantic ports of Spanish Latin America. And it was really basically a kind of financial engineering company, sort of a bank. And the idea was that there was all this debt out there. There was, you know, these tens of millions of dollars of long-term debt, often at very, very high interest rates on terrible terms. The debts would last for three lifetimes or 100 years, and they'd have these high interest rates, and they couldn't be redeemed. That is, if the government somehow managed to get some spare change, it couldn't pay off any of these debts early. So these were really, really bad obligations to have hanging on the British Treasury. So the South Sea Company leaders and their allies in the ministry decided to do well by doing good, as it were, try and get rich while at the same time addressing this problem. And so they proposed allowing the South Sea Company to buy all this outstanding debt for shares that would be newly issued in the South Sea Company itself. That sounds really weird, but it did have a logic to it. And the idea was the South Sea Company would get more trading capital, so it could be a bigger, better, faster, more wonderful mercantile company. The Treasury would get a lower interest rate, they would set interest rate, and they would get the right to redeem their debts. They could pay it off early if the money arrived. And, you know, the question is, well, those are two good things, but what do the punters get? What do the people who hold these really, to them, very advantageous government debts, the bonds and annuities and all the different, you know, particular flavors of debt that they had, what do they get for handing in this secure, if somewhat dull, steady stream of payments in for stock in this relatively new company? And the idea was twofold. One is they got to participate in a stock market boom if there ever was one. You know, if the stock rose, they would get more money. And secondly, they could get their money out whenever they wanted. Because if they held the government debt, all they got was the payments over time. But if they needed the underlying capital, if they, you know, bought a bond for 100 quid and were getting, you know, 7 or 8 pounds a year for it, if they needed 100 pounds for something, they couldn't get at it. Whereas with stock in a company that they could go down to Exchange Alley and sell, they could get their money out. So the idea was that everybody would win.
Okay,
and that's
so this
almost
is
how it turned out.
Hi, I'm Artemis. You'll know me as one of the presenters on this podcast. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. Through his work, Jordan brings some of the most significant historical events and people to life, whether it's his portrait of Charles Darwin, the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, or one of my personal favourites, which is his colourisation of the March on Washington in 1963. Looking at this photo, you can see hundreds of thousands of people gathered at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial who were brought to life through Jordan's colourisation work. And I think we're offered a glimpse of how powerful it must have been to be a member of that crowd, about to hear one of the most famous addresses of the 20th century, which was, of course, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's almost like you are a member of the crowd yourself. All of these images and many more are available as really beautiful prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. What's more, Travels Through Time listeners get 10% off when they use the code TTT at the checkout. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colourgraph.co. And that's colourgraph spelled C-O-L-O-R, colourgraph.co.
This is a story we're now going to explore, I suppose. The arc of which plays out, and some people might guess what's coming, but the details of it are really fascinating, and it's the details that we're going to try and get to now. So we're going to go through, as ever, in three scenes, and I've given you the opportunity to pick three moments in 1720 to talk about. Where would you like to go first, please?
Well, let's go to that lovely day in January where the deal is first presented to the full House of Commons. The urbane, intelligent, eloquent, and by his own contemporaries judged to be basically principledless, Chancellor of the Exchequer, John Aislaby. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I have no idea. It's a name I've only read.
No, I don't know either, but that looks like a good attempt.
Who's going to correct us now? He stands up in Commons and presents the outlines of the deal I just spoke of. South Sea Company gets all the debt. In order to purchase the debt, they're going to be allowed to issue new shares. And the Treasury gets these better terms for their loans, and the punters get to play in the stock market. What happened was first one member of Parliament and then the member of Parliament, Robert Walpole, stood up and said, not so fast, because part of the deal was that the South Sea Company was going to pay £3 million to the Treasury for the right to do this deal. Mm. And so the opposition, and Walpole was at this point out of power. He'd fought with his fellow Whigs and he'd been thrown out of the ministry a few years before. And he basically said, are there no more companies in the world? And specifically was clearly thinking of the Bank of England and perhaps the East India Company as people who could bid up the price for doing a deal like this. Mm-hmm. And he was able to persuade the two or three voices that spoke, you know, led by Walpole, were able to persuade Commons to say, yeah, let's have people come back in a week and make their best offers. That was exactly what the South Sea Company had wanted to avoid. And it was, you know, like I said, there was no principle really involved. It was just perhaps they were saying, let's do the best deal for the Treasury. But really what it was just if those guys said yes, we're going to mess with them. And they succeeded.
Well, there's a few things I just want to clarify here, because for me, financial history can be a bit tangled. And I've been getting it straight in my head because, of course, the difference here is, I think, is in modern 21st century idiom what you're describing a debt for equity swap, really? Is that it?
Yes, it is.
So you're like kind of they're going to load all of this debt into this one particular company, which is the South Sea Company. I'm not sure if that's its official title, but that's
how it's correct.
Remembered.
I mean, often when you speak of a debt for equity swap, you're talking about debt owed by a company for shares in the company. This is external debt being sold into a company and turning into equity in that company. But yes, it is exactly that.
But the South Sea Company had been around for like a decade or so by that point, is that right?
That's correct. It was founded in 1711, and it was always intended to be a hybrid. There was really an intention to try and create a successful trading enterprise, but it was always involved in some aspect of working on this problem of the giant, growing, intractable debt. Its original working capital was supposed to come from a similar, though not identical, and much, much smaller deal back in 1711.
Okay, so that strikes me as a really important point. So it wasn't set up as the East India Company was, for example, with this kind of great trading aspiration and then something else. It was, from the very beginning, to serve a secondary purpose for maybe helping out with the debt problem.
Yes, it was always a two-headed beast.
Do you know, can you tell us about this figure, John Blunt, who was a figure involved in the South Sea Company?
John Blunt is one of my favorite people in the entire book. He's a lovely villain, the central activating mind within the South Sea Company. And he's got a long history of being a guy who's just a little bit too clever, certainly for people like Daniel Defoe, who knew of him and certainly of his associates, whom he just scorned, referring to some of them as a triumvirate of modern thieving. What I like most about Blunt is that he's a full character. He's a real human. He's not simply a sort of cartoon bad guy who's just getting rich at the expense of everybody else. He's someone who is, if you asked him, he would say he was trying to do the right thing, trying to do good in the world. Mm-hmm. Certainly do well by doing good. Was clear throughout his career, he was motivated by getting as rich as it was possible to imagine being. in some ways, I see John Blunt as a kind of 18th century exemplar of the kind of people we both admire and scorn as, you know, like Silicon Valley bros.
Yeah.
He figured out that you could use joint stock companies in ways that people hadn't imagined before. He figured out that if you played with debt, you could do really exciting things. You could bring tomorrow into the present and you could pay for all kinds of things. He realized that if you offered people new ways to imagine making money, they would give you lots of money and you could actually dip your beak a bit and take some for yourself. But the idea was still to deliver something that was of value potentially to the people mm-hmm. whose money you were trying to draw into your affairs. I mean, Blunt was not simply a thief. He was somebody very much a man of his time, using new ideas that he and his times didn't fully understand, absolutely always trying to get rich. When things got out of hand, he didn't know what to do beyond try and ride the horse as far as it would take him. But he's, you know, and absolutely not at all a person of deep scruples or, you know, sort of, you don't look at him and think, oh, there is a man of integrity who will do yeah. what is right no matter what. But still, he was not somebody who was simply out there to rip you off. He wasn't a con man.
His relevance to this scene we're talking about now in the House of Commons is that he is really the protagonist, isn't he?
Yes. So John Blunt is vital to the story because he is the person who is the central active intelligence within the South Sea Company. He and a small handful of really close associates negotiate with the chancellor and the postmaster general, Craggs the Elder, and a few others to set up a situation where the South Sea Company will be the sole actor, the sole financial institution handling the entire British national debt. He wants to shut out the Bank of England. He wants to shut out any potential competitors. He wants all the goodies for himself and his company. Mm-hmm. And certainly John Blunt was somebody who would find out over the, you know, next 7, 8, 9 months of 1720 from this moment in Parliament where he pushes his deal out into the world for the first time, he'll find out over those next 3 seasons whether or not he, in fact, is one of those who can walk the walk or not.
It's a nice way of characterizing this. Like it's the moment when Blunt makes his play in public, because presumably before this moment in the Commons has been all the horse trading going on in the shadows, if you like. The deals have been struck and now it's got to be presented in a palatable form in a public assembly. Is that kind of right?
That's right. The deal has been very carefully negotiated. It's happened sort of from November into January, November 1719 into January of 1720. Mm-hmm. And the first rumors come out of the newspapers in the previous week or two before the 22nd, which is when this debate happens. And yeah, the goal at that moment is really to sort of shock and awe the Commons with this enormously ambitious deal. I mean, taking over 40 million pounds of 1720 debt is, you know, billions upon billions of dollars that would immediately transform, if it all came into the South Sea Company, transform that company into, you know, enormously, unprecedentedly, the largest private enterprise the world, not just in the world at the time, but the largest one the world had ever seen.
Wow.
So, I mean, and this is not a small move here.
No, this is a big play, isn't it? And you say, if anything, there's this, and this is looping back around to something that we're talking about a few minutes ago, when Robert Walpole stands up and he makes this intervention and he says, why not let other companies bid for this same opportunity?
Yeah, so the House of Commons convenes, the Chancellor gets up, he presents the deal. Another member of the ministry, Craggs the Elder, who is the Postmaster General, which is a hugely important position then, stands up to second and amplify his colleague's presentation of this, you know, amazing proposition that suddenly in this one fell swoop, all of Britain's debt problems are going to get captured in one place and presumably solved. All this is going great, and there's no sound of objection from the Commons for some period after the members of the ministry finish speaking. And then first one person stands and says, is this the only way we can go about it? And Walpole, who is famously the master of the Commons, I mean, he's just you know, throughout his career, he was recognized as a great power, you know, with great skills to manipulate how the House of Commons felt, what it thought, and what it would ultimately do. And he gets up and says, yeah, I mean, we've got this extraordinary deal, and maybe £3 million for the Treasury, which would be wonderful, but is that the limit of what we can get? Why don't we open this up to bid? Why don't we let other companies have a go at it? And this is, you know, seemingly a perfectly reasonable suggestion, and in fact, it sweeps through Commons, and they say, yes, let's do it. But it's really a huge blow to the South Sea Company and its allies in the ministry, who just wanted to have this thing happen fast, happen under terms that everybody could live with. And as it turned out, to happen under terms that if they had been accepted on that day, one can't say for certain, and there are reasons to think it might have gone the other way, but it really might have changed the outcome in certain crucial ways if the, you know, what came next actually hadn't transpired as it did.
Right. So it goes into a bit of a bidding war. Is that correct?
Yeah. So on this day, on January 22nd, Commons says, go away, come back in a week, and any company that wants to can offer a bid, and we'll discuss all of that. So at that point, the Bank of England, which is the older, the established firm, and in fact, the firm that has fought hard for the previous quarter of a century to maintain its essential monopoly on handling the government's finances, handling the government's checkbook, dealing with its debt, all that sort of stuff. They say, you know, we're not going to let this upstart, this newer company, this potential rival, to take away, you know, by far the largest part of the potential business one could have handling the government's finances. And they come back with a significantly improved offer that includes something on the order of a £5 million payment and other adjustments to the terms. And the South Sea Company essentially matches it. And so House Commons says, great, we've got two essentially similar offers. Go back and try again. And this time the South Sea Company says, we are not going to share this deal at all. There's a proposition that they, you know, that the Bank of England, South Sea Company, split the baby in some way. And John Blunt says famously, we will not split the baby. And they come in with an overwhelming offer.
So I think that's a really nice setup as the first part in what's going to be a three-act playing out. So let's go a few months on to your second scene. Where would you like to go to next?
Well, I think there is a Sunday in May when Daniel Defoe goes to church. He actually goes to a couple of churches. And this is about a month after the deal has gone live. So what happens is, from that debate in January, Parliament accepts the overwhelming South Sea bid. They take a month or so to turn that into legislation and pass it. And that happens. And then the actual start of this offering of South Sea stock and accepting of the government's debts into the company begins in April. At the same time, the company starts selling new shares on the open market. And this is where the magic of the deal for the South Sea Company, and it seems for its shareholders, really begins to take hold, because there was one very important detail that the South Sea Company held on to throughout the negotiations. And what they said is they never agreed to a specific price, the amount of shares that they would offer for any given amount of bonds or annuities or any of the financial instruments that people held as national debt. And that meant, in effect, they could price their shares at whatever the market would bear. And yet they were entitled under the terms of the deal to create new shares at par, a set figure of £100 per share, based on the agreed value in pounds of a given piece of debt. And there was a bunch of complicated little bits of arithmetic to find out what a piece of long-term debt or a short-term debt or any of these kinds of, you know, the different flavors that were being dealt with. But basically, if they had something that was worth, say, £1,500 as a bond, they would get to create 15 shares. So there would be 15 new shares of South Sea Company stock. But if the shares were selling at £300 on the open market, they would only have to pay out 5 shares, and they got to keep the rest of them, right? The other 10, which meant that the company had an asset now that was worth £3,000, money for nothing. You know, this is where, yeah, you know, it was like this alchemy that was just totally wonderful. And what this meant was the company got more and more valuable the more debt it took in. And they had more and more incentive to pump the share price up as high as it would go, because every time it went up higher, they would have to pay fewer shares out to get each new piece of debt that would make the company larger and more valuable.
It is like one of Newton's equations almost, isn't it?
Yes, except it's one of those ones that, you know, instead of he worked on these infinite series, and infinite series can collapse to a finite number or blow up to infinity. This was one of the ones that seemed to be blowing, you know, would just keep going and bigger and bigger. And the more debt it took in, the more valuable, blah, 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 blah. But it meant always that it looked like a great deal as long as the share prices were going up. And in the case of the South Sea bubble, it was in the low 100s at the start of the year. By the time the deal opened in mid-April, it was ticking up into the high 200s and even touched 300 a few times. In May, you're getting up into the 400s. It's going really quickly. So it had taken 3.5 months to go from 120 to 280 or so, 290. It takes 4 or 5 weeks at most to get from 280, 300 to over 400. So things are picking up speed. And one of the things that struck me throughout the reading I did for this book is that people are just enthralled by this. The stock market becomes the focus of everyone's attention. When I say everyone, I mean not just the money guys who hang out in the city of London, not just the already rich, but really all kinds of people. So Daniel Defoe on a Sunday in early May goes to church and he writes this article about his experience. And he says, you know, I sit down in the pews and I can't hear the sermon. The ladies right in front of me are saying, did you sell? No, I've heard it will rise again and I'll sell tomorrow. And this person goes, how goes the stock or what news and so forth. And then he leaves that church and he's walking around. He goes past a Quaker meeting house. And the significance of that, of course, is the Quakers often used as sort of symbols of sobriety and calmness and all that. And he says, on the porch of the Quaker church, it's, you know, have you sold? Will you sell? What's the number? But he's fascinated by the whole prospect of getting and spending. He loves seeing how people do things in the world. And he's both horrified and fascinated by the world, specifically this new world of a market in money. You know, he lives enormously in markets of things and projects and, you know, making material changes to the world. And he understands that finance is vital. And he, at one point, writes this marvelous essay where he praises Britain's innovations in national finance by explicitly comparing it to a kind of clockwork mechanism that to his readers would have been instantly recognizable as a Newtonian reference, as a reference to that clockwork universe. That is one of the early images of, you know, early ideas of both modernity and this kind of new way of achieving mastery over the world. But at the same time, he saw Exchange Alley and the trade in money as inherently sinful and dishonest and placing individuals' interests against that of the nation. So he's got this really ambivalent view of the South Sea project.
Again, I suppose this is May, and you describe this as a time of hopeful madness, which is a lovely description.
Thank you. It is. I mean, at this point, everything's going great.
So let's move on a few months more and see what's happening next. Where would you like to go to for your third scene?
Where I'd like to go next, I think the third act of this play is after the, you know, these wonderful, hopeful months in May and then in June when it goes even higher. Let's look to the moment when everybody suddenly is aware that it's gone all pear-shaped, that things just haven't worked out. And in fact, quite the reverse. It's dreadful. It's a disaster. Spring is wonderful. May is a hopeful month. June is spectacular. It seems, you know, the share price goes all the way up to £1,000 from, again, you know, low hundreds at the beginning of the year, 300 when the deal opened. I mean, people are getting seriously, unprecedentedly, hugely beyond the dreams of avarice wealthy, at least on paper. That's how it stays over the summer. I mean, the share price kind of noodles around. It doesn't keep rising the same way, but it's up there. It's high. It looks good. People are feeling fine. And then September comes. And when September comes, misery follows. Things start to fall apart. By the end of the month, the share is hundreds of pounds down. By December, the prices of the shares have returned all the way just about to where they were at the beginning of the year. Back in, you could go to Change Alley and pick up a share of South Sea stock for somewhere in the £100 kind of price range. And so the third act, the third place I would like to go to now is December 20th, just before Christmas, 1720. And we're back in the House of Commons. And at this point, you know, you don't have bold, brave masters of the 18th century universe getting up on their hind legs and telling the Commons how they're going to save Britain from its debt and so forth and so on. You have Robert Walpole, now returned to power, now with increasing authority, now being seen as the one man possibly who could save the day. And he is shepherding through the Commons the legislation that's going to sort of basically settle the mess. So enormous financial losses have happened. The richest man in England, Duke of Portland, Henry Bentinck, has gone more than bankrupt. He bought way more than he owned in forward contracts. So he didn't have to put up any money, but he risked more money than he had. And now he is worth much less than zero. He's in trouble. Isaac Newton, the smartest man in Europe at the time, maybe still, lost his shirt, you know, and hundreds and thousands of less famous people.
Because this is the point you were making before, that it wasn't just, I suppose, a small group of people who were invested. This was something that had gone as far as the Quakers and beyond.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing that was remarkable about the South Sea Bubble was that just as the financial experiments that led to it were new, so was this whole idea that this sort of democratization of who could play in the financial markets. Yes, the great and the good risked their money, but so did lots and lots of much less wealthy people, ordinary people, country gentry, merchants, and even town tradespeople. I mean, men and women. There were lots and lots of people who took a flutter on the South Sea stock market, and a few of them got out in a timely fashion, but many, many more rode the pony up and rode it back down the hill again, much to their sorrow. So the big question that came after that is, you have this thing, and you know there are accusations of fraud, and there's some truth to them. There are accusations of manipulative and bad behavior, and there's much more truth to them. There were accusations that the South Sea Company engaged in a systematic campaign of bribery to get its deal through, and that's absolutely true. Hundreds of members of Parliament, both in the Commons and the Lords, were bribed. Members of the King's Court were bribed. Probably at least one, and maybe both, of the King's principal mistresses got sweeteners. I mean, there was lots of bad behavior around the bubble, as well as lots of just, we've never done this before, we don't know what we're doing, quote, honest mistakes. And it was all there in the same package, a stew of disaster. The question coming out of that was, do we say, oh, this was just all a terrible idea, we're going to undo all the deals? So South Sea Company gets its stock back, everybody gets their debt back, we go back to the old way of handling things.
It's almost like an 18th century bailout, is that what you're describing?
So the question is, do you bail out, or do you say, no, the losses are real, you got to live with it? Robert Walpole was a great parliamentary leader and a really effective politician. He was not, as it has sometimes been suggested, himself a deeply insightful financial thinker. He had good people around him, he talked to people, but the one true genius decision he made, even though he was not, again, not a financial genius, was that he said, no, the deal stands. We're not going to bail people out. Because from the point of view of the nation, the South Sea bubble did exactly what it was supposed to do. They wanted to take this enormous mountain of national debt, composed of lots of individual pieces, each of which had different terms, each of which had different legal settings, each of which behaved in its own particular way, all of which wasn't liquid, all of which made it hard to borrow each new time because you had to come up with yet another new plan, another new form of loan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He said, no, all of that stuff got traded into South Sea Company shares. The South Sea Company itself is now essentially a big pile of bonds. The Treasury pays interest on the amount of debt that was absorbed that goes to the South Sea Company's income. South Sea Company pays that out as interest. And if people want to and they want to get their money out, they can sell their shares, which carry this payout every year. And that's great. That's what we want. We want to be able to do that again, issue more bonds of the same sort. We never want to have to deal with the old way of raising money again. And we certainly don't want to go back to paying the same high rates of interest with these inflexible, non-redeemable loans. So he said, yep, every transaction that occurred during the last year, you're stuck with it. Wow. And that was the breakthrough. That was the triumph of the financial revolution. Because from that period, over about the next 30 years, effectively, Britain refined and expanded what was essentially the world's first modern bond market. That sounds kind of dull. But again, in finance, dull is great. Dull is what you want. Dull is the most wonderful thing you can have if you're trying to raise money, if you're trying to be somebody who wants a reliable, secure source of income, if you're a nation that wants to do things like create an empire around the world, send navies, you know, send fleets of your ships various places, engage in a century-long contest with France, all those kinds of things. Oh, and by the way, maybe even ultimately, in various ways, help people pay for new kinds of industries and things that will eventually develop into the Industrial Revolution. All of these things turn on being able to raise money, essentially borrowing from the future, paying a rent on that money, that's the interest, against that future, and use that money in the here and now to do something that needs doing in the present.
Is it fair to say, this is what I'm wondering, that all of that that comes after is down to having a faith in this market system which is being pioneered at that time? And can we trace it back to the 20th of December 1720 and that statement from Walpole in the Commons?
I argue in the book, and I deeply and wholly believe, that so much of the world of modern finance derives from not just the South Sea bubble itself, but the way Walpole and the British government responded to what to do after the collapse. That when they decided, yes, that making finance simple, smooth, boring, and consistent was more important than restoring the fortunes of people who imprudently risked their wealth on this dream of infinite wealth. So when the time comes to go before Parliament and say, are we going to bail people out, or are we going to stick with what we've gained as a nation from doing this deal, from putting all this debt, all this, you know, just ridiculous Joseph's coat mixture of various forms of debt into this one lovely, simple instrument called South Sea Company stock, Walpole made a very clear, and certainly seeing what people have done since, courageous and perhaps difficult decision to say, yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to stick with the bargain we made, even if many of the people who are, you know, the backbone of Britain will suffer greatly for it. Wow. So in the Commons on December 20th, he stands up and he says, the South Sea Act was made to relieve the nation from, quote, its encumbrances and public debts and putting them in a method of being paid off in a few years. We told you what we were doing. You chose to do it. You got burned. It's on you. We're going to see what the nation's interests are and pursue those. Very, very, you know, critical moment in British financial, in fact, global financial history.
Well, that's one of the absolutely fascinating qualities of the book, but looks in two ways. Back to the scientific revolution that happened over the 50 years before to show the forces that are at play, and then just showing how that's extrapolated outwards afterwards. It's a wonderful book full of nimble storytelling. There's lots of lovely anecdotes in there about the introduction of coffee and how shares were first written down and published and printed. And I love the little trips you take us on into Exchange Alley. So let's kind of move away from 1720. But before we do, let's ask you one last question, please. If you could bring a tangible memento back with you from that year, 1720, to today, 400 years later, what would you like to have?
I guess there are two things that I immediately think of.
Yeah.
And one thing I would love to have actually is a pocket watch from that period, because it was such a technologically, really just an extraordinary accomplishment, you know, of the previous decades. You know, the whole clockwork idea was such a powerful metaphor for the idea that human ingenuity was bringing order into the understanding of the material world. And the one other thing, I would love to have a fresh off-the-press Defoe screed, something, you know, really polemical. And if I could track down the man himself, get him to sign it, and then transport that wonderful object to the 21st century and stare at it with a grin.
Well, do you know what? I've just been told that you've been long-listed for the FT Business Book of the Year Award. So maybe what we'll do as a kind of little gift from us is we'll let you have two mementos this week instead of the usual one as a kind of little congratulatory present. How about that?
That's so kind of you. I deeply appreciate it.
Okay. You'll just have to imagine them into existence. All right. Well, Thomas Levinson, it's been a real pleasure. The book, as I say, is... it's just so much fun. It's so informative. And it's, as someone who loves the 18th century anyway, it's opened my eyes to financial history, which is sometimes hard to get a grasp on. But I think you just describe it so well. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I've greatly enjoyed our conversation.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Thomas Levinson about his new book, Money for Nothing, The South Sea Bubble and the Invention of Modern Capitalism. As I mentioned, the book has just been longlisted for the prestigious FT Business Book of the Year Award, which is no surprise as it really is enthralling. It's out on the 3rd of September in hardback from Head of Zeus. We're going to be back on Friday this week with a special episode of Travels Through Time published on the 28th of August, which of course is the anniversary of the March on Washington. There's going to be news of another special prize to be won then, so please do listen out. But for now, and from me, that's it. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.